This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Shannon Young. Coming up on the program, after 10 days of airstrikes, the Israeli military launches a ground invasion of the Gaza Strip. The FCC receives more than 1 million comments on net neutrality ahead of a Friday night deadline. And Cameroon attempts to revive its coffee sector 2 decades after structural adjustment programs ended its government support system. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. The death toll in Gaza is on the rise as Israeli tanks moved into the territory Thursday. Medical sources say more than 260 Palestinians have been killed, and according to the United Nations, the vast majority were civilians. One Israeli soldier died on the first day of the ground invasion, the second Israeli fatality within the context of Operation Protective Edge. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, at least another 20 people died before dawn Friday. The ground invasion has prompted thousands of Palestinians to flee their homes in the northern Gaza Strip. On Friday, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, or UNRWA, estimated at least 40,000 residents of northern and southern Gaza have sought shelter in other parts of the Gaza Strip, UNRWA spokesperson Chris Gunness.
We are basically doing emergency food, emergency water, providing hygiene, because they're taking refuge mainly in UNRWA schools, which are built for 1,000 kids to be educated in, not for thousands of people to come to for days and days of permanent accommodation.
What's the biggest challenge the agency is currently facing on the ground in Gaza?
Security. We are very concerned that, as in Operation Half-Lead, so-called, in 2008-2009, UNRWA facilities may receive direct hits, as they did then, most worryingly in those days, by white phosphorus. And we hope that that sort of incident will not occur again when the Israeli army hit us with white phosphorus. But we have to see and we have to pray that all parties, and we appeal to all the warring parties, to respect civilian life and the sanctity of UN property and, of course, humanitarian workers.
Gaza's only rehabilitation hospital for paralyzed and disabled patients was severely damaged by Israeli shelling Thursday. The Al-Wafa hospital had sustained other attacks in the past week, including a missile strike which hit a wing for elderly residents. The Israeli military claimed rockets had been fired from the area. Joe Catron is an international solidarity movement activist who volunteered at the Al-Wafa hospital. He says he neither saw nor heard evidence of what he could identify as rocket fire from the vicinity of the hospital.
There were any number of military sounds in the area. We mostly stayed inside the building for reasons of safety. But the loudest by far were those coming from the Israeli side, tank shelling, airstrikes, and the constant drones overhead. Certainly that was the military activity that was closest to the hospital. I never heard anything closer about which there could possibly have been any doubt.
The Gaza Strip lacks underground bomb shelters. With no designated safe place to wait out the airstrikes, many residents of the Gaza Strip have been staying indoors out of fear. FSRN's Rami Almigari has more from Gaza.
In the Maghazi refugee camp in central Gaza Strip, the Al-Tala' family just finished their breakfast or iftar meal following a prolonged fasting day during Ramadan. Like thousands of families here, the Al-Tala' household has been living under a cloud of stress in the past days due to the continuous Israeli army shelling in the area. Abu Yazid Al-Tala' is the head of the 8-member family. He says one of the worst feelings is that the dead are seen only as a statistic outside of Gaza.
We are not just numbers, and it appears we've turned into merely numbers in the eyes of world countries. How can these countries remain patient towards the wholesale killing of us? Where is their humanity?
The Al-Tala' family lives in a modest home in an alleyway of the Maghazi refugee camp. Abu Yazid Al-Tala's wife, Yazid, fears for the well-being of their 6 children.
Sometimes my son wants to go to the grocery store to buy a yogurt or something. I then start to worry that he may not return back home safe. A while ago, my son and daughter were too scared to go outside to fill up the gas canister. I know this fear will impact them in the future.
The ongoing Israeli military offensive in Gaza has left the population of the coastal territory coping with regular power outages. Health officials say hospitals are short of essential medical supplies and fuel needed to keep backup generators running. Power outages in Gaza now last up to 10 hours a day due to massive damage to electrical infrastructure. On Thursday, the Israeli cabinet announced the military campaign will continue for more than a week, now with a ground invasion. Only a tiny minority of Gaza residents with foreign passports have been able to flee the enclave. Most of the civilian population, including the 8-member Al-Talaa family, have nowhere to run and nothing to do but hope for the best. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
An American teenager of Palestinian descent who was beaten unconscious by Israeli police 2 weeks ago has returned to his home in Florida. Tariq Kadir was welcomed by dozens of friends, family, and supporters late Wednesday night at Tampa International Airport. FSRN's Sean Kanan reports.
Tariq Kadir looked like any other teenager when he was greeted, hugged, and kissed by family at the airport arrivals gate. But in photos and a video taken 2 weeks ago, his face was badly bruised and swollen. He was beaten after a protest over the murder of his cousin, Mohammed Abu Kadir, who had been abducted and burned alive by Israeli extremists. Tariq Kadir made a brief statement shortly after his arrival in Tampa.
I know he must have been terrified, like I was. I was in a new place and suddenly attacked by mass police. It was by far the scariest thing that has ever happened to me. The physical pain in those first hours was really rough. And I'm only 15, but I will never think about freedom in the same way as I did two months ago. I want to ask you all to please remember my cousin Muhammad and the 36 kids that died in Gaza. And over the past several days, they have names like mine. I hope the violence will stop for their sake. No child, whether they are Palestinian or Israeli, deserves to die that way.
The teenager did not take questions from reporters at the airport. The executive director of the Florida chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations, Hassan Shibli, says Kadir will get medical attention for injuries sustained during the beating.
I asked him, Tariq, how are you doing? He said, you know, I still hurt, especially on the inside. His eyes were still red from the bloodshot and the veins that they burst when they kicked him. But thank God, he's just so excited to be back. A lot of friends, a lot of family, a lot of love, a lot of support. It's really probably the most rewarding night I've ever had at CARE. And I think, you know, just seeing Tariq home and smiling made all of our efforts really worthwhile.
Now that Tariq Kadir is back home in Tampa, he says he just wants to go fishing with his friends. This was the first time U.S.-born Kadir had visited relatives in Jerusalem in over 10 years. Sean Kanan, FSRN, Tampa.
The deadline for public comment on proposed new federal rules for the Internet is fast approaching. So far, the Federal Communications Commission has received more than 1 million comments about the potential changes to the net neutrality principle. The term net neutrality refers to the concept that online data and websites should receive equal treatment from internet service providers. Some telecom companies support the creation of a two-tiered system with a premium fast lane. For more on the proposed rules and the public response, I spoke with Michael Weinberg, Vice President of Public Knowledge, a D.C.-based organization focusing on internet, consumer rights, and copyright issues. The FCC has extended its public comment period for changing net neutrality rules. The last day was supposed to be Tuesday, but the window has been extended to midnight Friday night. Why the extension?
Because their website couldn't handle the number of comments they were getting. So many people wanted to weigh in on this issue that the website crashed. And so in order to make it up to people, they are extending the deadline until Friday.
As far as you know, are the comments divided on the issue or heavily weighed towards a certain position?
We haven't done a total analysis, but from what we can tell from our preliminary analysis, they are overwhelmingly in favor of net neutrality and against the proposed rules from the FCC. I mean, people are weighing in, and they support an open internet. You can find comments from large ISPs who like the FCC's rules, but besides the internet service providers, you have to look pretty long and hard for people who think that the FCC's rules are good or an open internet is bad.
A federal court in January struck down the concept of slow lanes for internet traffic, but it did not explicitly rule out the creation of fast lanes. What exactly do the proposed FCC rules say about two-tiered service?
Yeah, in January, the court struck down the FCC's versions of the rules that actually prohibited any sort of discrimination or blocking. But the new rules, in order to comply with some of the parts of that ruling, what they do is they allow internet service providers to create fast lanes and slow lanes online. And they say the idea is that there's a slow lane that's available for everyone, and then a fast lane can be made available just for companies or for websites that can pay an extra fee that the ISP gets to set.
Does public knowledge advocate any particular concrete solution for ensuring net neutrality?
Yeah, I think that there's a pretty straightforward thing, set of things that the FCC can do. The first thing and the most important thing is for them to create really clear, straightforward rules that say no blocking, no discrimination. ISPs cannot be involved in that sort of behavior. In order to do that, they have to do some technical legal things. One of the things they need to do is to classify broadband access as a Title II service. That's the same regulatory category as the phone network has traditionally used. Some people call it common carriage. But the really important thing isn't the regulatory classifications. The important thing is that there are clear rules that prevent ISPs from picking winners and losers online and deciding which services you can reach as quickly as you want to reach them.
That was Michael Weinberg of Public Knowledge. He joined us by phone from Washington, D.C. On Monday, police arrested 24 protesters for blocking the entrances of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC. The demonstrators were cited, fined, and released. They were protesting what they called FERC's rubber stamp approval process for an export facility for liquefied natural gas, or LNG, in a heavily populated area of southern Maryland called Cove Point. It's one of 14 such proposed facilities around the country. The Monday action came after about 2,000 people marched from the National Mall to the FERC on Sunday. Much of the natural gas slated for export through Cove Point and similar facilities would be extracted through the process of fracking. That's leading anti-fracking groups to form an alliance with opponents of LNG export terminals. Melinda Tuhus sent this report from Washington, D.C.
No Cove Point! No Cove Point!
Busloads of Cove Pointers arrived in red T-shirts for the rally on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Claire Zepko was there with her children, ages 2 and 6.
We're worried about the long-term effects to our health from the emissions, from the all of the nasty chemicals that are going to be dissipating into the atmosphere. Dominion's brought pollution credits from Frederick, Maryland, but that does absolutely nothing for our air quality down on Cove Point.
Residents and advocates like the Chesapeake Climate Action Network, CCAN, which organized the rally, wants FERC to require Dominion, the owner of the liquefied natural gas terminal, to do an environmental impact statement, or EIS, in addition to the less comprehensive environmental assessment it conducted. A FERC spokeswoman said she couldn't comment specifically on Cove Point, but that if a full study was done when the site was developed several years ago as an LNG import, not export facility, another one would not be required since the new proposal does not exceed the footprint of the existing facility. Mike Tidwell, founder and executive director of CCAN, scoffed at that.
Completely different industrial machines, totally different process, much more dangerous, much bigger, and FERC doesn't think there should be an environmental impact statement. They think the EIS from 2006 for a $700 million facility is enough to cover in 2014 a $3.8 billion facility. It's ridiculous.
Tidwell said this is the only LNG proposal in the country that's planned for a populated area. Local resident Claire Zepko calls Dominion's plans to expand the facility incompatible with the reality of a neighborhood in which children bike up and down the street and play in a park directly in front of the plant.
They're going to add a liquefaction train that's like 2 football fields long and 100 feet high. It's going to be running 24/7. They're adding a 130-megawatt power plant to the site that they're going to run off natural gas turbines.
She said Dominion ignored industry guidelines that such facilities should be built only in remote areas, adding that the county actually waived the zoning requirements so they could turn it into an industrial area. One of the speakers at the rally was Sandra Steingraber, a biologist, author, and a leader of the anti-fracking movement in New York. She said their destinies are intertwined because LNG exports would lead to an increase in fracking.
To the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and to President Obama, we say we are not willing to blow up the bedrock of our nation in order to extract the fossil fuel called methane that will in turn blow up our climate. And we are not willing to liquefy the results using more fossil fuels and so give methane a passport to foreign markets and so further entrench a fossil fuel dependency around the globe in a time of climate emergency. We say no to that.
Mike Tidwell of CCAN said FERC does more to facilitate the production of natural gas than to regulate it.
They've never denied a major electrical or gas project ever presented to them, ever. And so they're an isolated, non-responsive commission that does not take into account public safety or health. And instead, all they do is try to further the profits of the fossil fuel industry.
Plans to increase the nation's natural gas export infrastructure come as Europe's largest gas supplier, Russia, is locked in a dispute with Ukraine, where key pipelines carrying Russian gas to Central and Western Europe are located. Are export facilities like the one in Cove Point meant to step in to fill a need at a moment of political crisis? In a phone interview before Sunday's rally, Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program, explained how the business works.
All the trade from LNG exports are going to be typically structured as 20-year locked-in deals, where nearly all of the export capacity is already slated for specific customers. Not a single bit of this is slated to go to Ukraine or anything like that. These are not national determinations. These are private marketplace determinations depending upon who negotiates the supply agreements.
FERC's decision is expected in the next several months. The Maryland Public Service Commission must also give an opinion on whether the proposed LNG export facility is in the public's interest. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
Recidivism rates in Kansas have dropped dramatically since the state's Department of Corrections introduced a mentoring program which pairs inmates slated for release with community role models. Other states have started to take notice and are turning to Kansas for advice about how to implement similar measures. FSRN's Joe Cadot has more from Wichita.
Mentoring for Success, a program of the Kansas Department of Corrections, has matched more than 4,000 released offenders with mentors in the last 3 years.
I can't speak, sorry.
Mentee Kyle Kelly spoke at a recent press conference in Wichita about the program.
Somebody's there to talk to you when you need them the most, and I get more out of it than I can ever describe.
Kelly was released last November after serving 3 years for attempted murder. 6 months before his release, Kelly was assigned a mentor who he says gave him the confidence to get a job. The Mentoring for Success program is an initiative implemented by Kansas Governor Sam Brownback.
Kyle was telling me outside about he's just signed on with an asphalt company where he's getting, looking forward, saying we've got some opportunity upside here, we've got health benefits with it, the 401k plan, and maybe in a year or two and I can be a foreman, they've told me with the group. And I thought, that's great work. Way to go. Doing that.
The governor's initiative has a simple premise: connect inmates with a mentor at least 6 months before the end of their sentences. Mentors offer advice and support during the first year of release. The idea is to cut recidivism rates. Gloria Geither is the mentoring director for the Kansas Department of Corrections. She says lack of family and friends is one of the biggest hurdles offenders face when trying to reintegrate back into the community.
It's normal things that you and I take for granted every day. You know, when we're driving to work or we have a bad day at work, we pick up the phone and we call a support system that we have, a family member, a friend that we know. Our offenders do not have that relationship in their life.
And that support system, simply having someone to talk to, goes a long way.
My name is Jose Huerta. I'm a junior.
In 2001, Huerta was convicted of aggravated burglary and rape. He says he saw his two daughters grow up in pictures.
There's not one day that I do not wish I could have took back all the bad I ever did in my life for them. have made promises that I broke to them. Those are the worst feelings and the worst things you can do when you're locked up, especially if you have kids or family.
In January of 2014, 6 months before his release, Huerta was paired with mentor Jim Gardner, a Kansas Red Cross worker. Huerta says his relationship has been a lifeline.
When you have someone who doesn't know you and is getting to know you, they can see you as what you want to become, which is a changed individual. Not saying, well, you know, this is what you were. I mean, you're not going to change. And that's not what one needs. One needs someone to tell you, hey, you're a good person. Granted, you did bad things, but you're not the same. You're going to change because I can see it in you. That's one of the main things that a lot of people need, because without that, I mean, what do you really have?
Huerta now works as a machinist in a Wichita area factory and has been mending his relationship with his family. Mentor Jim Gardner says the match has been positive for him as well.
Society tends to want to say they don't deserve a chance to change, and they don't believe that they can. And people are judge way too quickly when it comes to these men, when all along they look at themselves and they might even realize, you know, they could be in the same place as Jose was. They just didn't get caught. In the past, once they're out of prison, they just say they go without family, or maybe they don't have a place to go. They don't have any kind of support. And society wants to say, well, just that's just too bad. You know, just go deal with it yourself. And a mentor can help them change that and let them know that they are worthy, that they are worth something because they are trying to change their lives. And I'm blessed to have Jose as a friend.
The Kansas Department of Corrections have implemented measures such as job training, reading, and higher education, as well as drug and alcohol treatment programs, which have reduced the statewide recidivism rate by half in the last 10 years. While a 20% reincarceration rate is well below the national average of about 48%, the Mentoring for Success program has cut Kansas's already low recidivism rate by more than half in the year it's been measured. And the success is creating waves. 12 states have already toured the Kansas DOC to learn about its mentoring program, including North Carolina, which has the worst recidivism rate in the nation. The Mentoring for Success program hits the three-year mark this month. A larger picture of its success will come when its data is compared with that of states that measure recidivism by the likeliness that former inmates will be convicted of a new crime within 36 months of release. Joe Kadat, FSRN, Wichita.
The government of Cameroon has launched a wide-ranging program to rehabilitate old coffee plantations and open up new ones in an attempt to revive its once-flourishing coffee sector. The African nation used to be one of the world's largest coffee exporters, but structural adjustment programs implemented in the wake of a financial crisis more than 20 years ago forced the government to end price guarantees and trade protections for coffee producers. FSRN's Gala Killian Chimtum traveled to Cameroon's coffee-producing region and files this report.
It is 5:30 p.m. in Gelemunduka, a rural community in Cameroon's eastern region. 55-year-old Ebane Sol Blaise Lebon is still working on his 7.5-acre coffee plantation. It is a tedious exercise that involves manual weeding and pest control. He works daily from dawn to dusk in the hope of reviving the yield. 20 years ago, Ebane could harvest up to 100 bags or 13,000 pounds of coffee from the land, but not anymore.
These plantations don't yield anything now because we don't have fertilizers. We have been given herbicides, but we do not know how to use them, and they instead seem to harm the farms. Per hectare productivity is falling, so I can cultivate 3 hectares of land and not harvest up to 20 bags of coffee in a year.
The government suspended subsidies to the coffee sector more than 2 decades ago in the wake of an economic crisis. As a result, many farmers abandoned their coffee plantations, which suffered from neglect. Ome Malede Gaitan is the executive secretary of Cameroon's Coffee and Cocoa Interprofessional Council.
Cameroon used to be one of the biggest coffee producers in Africa, in the world. In 1980, we were the 8th world coffee producer. In 1992, when we liberalized the sector, Cameroon was the 12th world coffee producer. Today, we have the 30th coffee producer.
According to the Coffee and Cocoa Interprofessional Council, coffee production in the Central African country has plummeted by 56% over the past 3 years. Maledi says when the government eliminated subsidies and trade protections for the sector in the 1990s, the cost of inputs like fertilizer spiked. The increased cost of production coupled with low market prices at the time discouraged farmers, many of whom turned to food crop cultivation instead. Memories of better days are often part of discussions amongst villagers here. The absence of government subsidies and lack of regulations which fix minimum prices have allowed middlemen to take advantage of small-scale producers. Coffee farmer Laurentine Mengu says she is often unable to cover the cost of production, much less profit from her labor.
Middlemen come here with just $20. They get a bag of coffee, and we know they can resell it for at least $50. I think the state needs to fix prices for coffee. We find it hard selling our product, especially with fluctuating prices.
The government of Cameroon has launched an initiative to dramatically increase coffee production by 2020. To do this, the National Cocoa and Coffee Interprofessional Council developed an emergency program to fast-track production. Its executive secretary, Ome Gaitan Maledi, says the program involves working with farmer cooperatives in the country's main production basins.
We have a program in CICC named New Generation. New Generation is a program for youth. And in this program, we introduce 200 young people every year. And we give them support during 3 years. That means that from next year, we will have 600 young people every year. That gives me hope that we will relaunch this sector.
The Cameroon Minister of Agriculture and Rural Development, Esime Menye, has said the government will once again subsidize the sector to help farmers get inputs like fertilizers and insecticides. Even if Cameroon were to meet its production targets, better marketing strategies are necessary. Marty Foncha of the African Coffee Trading Group says only 5% of Cameroon's coffee is processed locally, but his group has developed approaches that would allow domestic producers to charge a higher price for their coffee.
The coffee that we pop, we don't wash. We take a lot of care to dry very, very quickly so it doesn't get moldy. When that coffee is dry, we've developed a new market for roasting where we roast it completely in its parchment. We don't shell it. We preserve the sugars and the flavors that come from the sugary mucilage. When somebody roasts it and grinds it and makes a cup of coffee, it becomes a very different drink. It doesn't taste harsh like coffee. It's like a nice herbal drink with a coffee background.
Figures from the National Institute of Statistics indicate that over 6 million Cameroonians depend on coffee for their livelihood. And with prospects that the crop will continue to grow in importance globally, Maledi believes boosting production is critical to the revival of Cameroon's economy. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And that does it for this week's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. For more information, please visit our website at fsrn.org. From Oaxaca, Mexico, I'm Shannon Young. Thanks for listening.